Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the show. This is our 15th episode now of the Dubai Life podcast with your hosts, myself, Liam Jeffrey, and Mr. Richard Crossley, aka Luxury Rental Dubai. You can follow him on Instagram. Later on in this episode, we have another guest for you all, the extraordinary Mr. Jason Hayes, aka the Billion Dollar Broker. Truly very excited to have Jason on the show today. I'm sure you're all going to enjoy this one. Now, before we start, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we really, really appreciate it. I know we drum on about this, but if you could leave us a rating, it will help us get up the rankings and get this show out to more people like yourselves who will hopefully take away some value and enjoy the shows. So, Richard, how have we been keeping you well?
Very well as ever. Yep.
Yeah.
It's pretty much Groundhog Day, as I keep saying, but
I know.
And again, All's good. What about you?
All good. We've got to be careful that we're not just talking about the same things because, you know, there isn't much to do. We're in lockdown, aren't we? I'm well. I'm trying to keep healthy, inspired by Megan the other day.
You know, I was just about to say that. I thought Megan was an excellent guest. So sort of passionate and so dynamic. It actually made me feel good. It actually sort of made me think about a few things to be more active. Just be active, you know, just...
Yeah.
Luckily, I've got a garden, so I can like stretch myself out a little bit in the garden.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm enjoying that.
Yeah, again,
we're quite lucky as well at the minute. The weather isn't the normal end of April weather, is it? It's quite cool.
It is, isn't it? The last couple of days has been overcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great time to go on the golf course.
I know. I can see the golf course from my balcony, and every time I'm outside on the balcony, I'm just waiting for the days. That's probably now the most... the biggest thing that I'm looking forward to is to get back out on the golf course.
Indeed. Can't wait. I mean, I had my 3-day pass yesterday to go off to Waitrose. And
how was it?
It's weird, isn't it? Like, you get excited about going to Waitrose and like stroking vegetables and in gloves, of course. But it's just weird that the world we find ourselves in. And do you know what? I was going to say to you, I think we should give a shout out to the delivery boys of Dubai.
100%.
Even in normal times, they work the socks off, and I guess in normal times, it's more dangerous with a lot more cars on the road. But can you imagine the pressure that they're under now just to deliver anything and everything?
I know. Well, even InstaShop now is, a 2-day delivery time. They must be absolutely just run off their feet. They must be nonstop. Every time they come to the door, I always give them a little tip, even more than usual. I just think they're doing a great job. And they must be, you know, working all hours and thinking, these, you know, lucky so-and-sos getting time off to spend at home with the family, and they're just working 24/7. And let's face it, they don't get paid a lot, do they?
No, they don't.
But yeah, they really deserve a shout out.
They do, so full respect. And again, that sort of led me on to think of a bit more as well. Because, I mean, here we are in Dubai.
Yeah.
And again, it's sort of opened my eyes. I couldn't believe when I first came to Dubai, you know, my company put me in JLT. And I can remember one of the guys saying, oh, I need some cigarettes. And we had a shop down below us. So I thought, okay, right, I'll see you in 10 minutes. He goes, what do you mean? I'll just phone. And he actually phoned down for somebody to come up with one pack of cigarettes.
I know. You know,
but it's just a weird society. And I can understand why. And again, I was reading about Cafu. I've never used them. You know, the guys who actually come to your house and fill your car up.
Yeah, they deliver the petrol, right?
Yeah. Have you tried that yet?
I've never tried it. No, I've seen them around. I know a lot of my friends have tried it, but I've never had to do it. I think there was one time at the golf club where I needed the petrol and I was running late for a meeting, and I was literally trying to chase down a Cafu van, but I missed them. I think you've got to do it through the app. I don't think you can.
Yeah, apparently you've got to sign up with them and give them your credit details, all that kind of stuff before you do it. So you just got this vision of you chasing a Cafu van down the street. Stop.
It was just perfect. No. I was like, this will mean I don't have to waste time.
Again, it always surprised me when I first came to Dubai, the queues at petrol stations. Here we are in an oil-rich sort of area of the world. And you'd have thought, in England, we pull into a petrol station and get served within, 2 or 3 minutes, virtually every time. It's very, very rare it goes beyond that. Yet here in Dubai, when I first came, I was queuing for like 15, 20 minutes sometimes just to get to the pumps. So, you know, and again, I always thought, oh, Cafu, it's a little bit too much of a luxury. But now, when I was reading this lady, it made perfect sense. She said, I'm very busy. I don't have time to wait for 20 minutes.
Isn't it?
at the pumps.
Yeah, time, I think, is the biggest commodity. And I think that if you look at businesses that have been successful over the past few years, Uber, you know, all the stuff with delivery online, it's all about saving people time, isn't it? And they reckon now that the next frontier, the next big technology that's going to come through is voice. So, you know, obviously we've got the Alexa systems and the Siri and the Google Home. Everything's going to be done through voice. So you literally, at the moment, we think it's a luxury that we can just call up an order. But in the future, we won't even have to call up. We'll just be like, hey, Alexa, I need toothpaste. Order me some more toothpaste. And that'll be it. And your order will be filled. And you'll never need to think about shopping. It'll just be instantaneous.
But come on, think about it. I mean, I'm getting a little bit worried. You know, I know this lockdown has taken us away from the normal social contact, but I enjoy social, as you probably gather. I enjoy talking. Yeah. I enjoy sitting outside Costa and just chatting to anybody and everybody. I mean,
yeah, it's just scary.
Where are we going with this? I mean, will we go back to a normal Dubai where people interact? I should imagine we will, but I think a lot of people have learned a lot of things or enjoyed a lot of things that this lockdown has brought to them.
Yeah.
And will they keep it? I mean, look at Megan. Oh, yeah, we're delivering spin bikes to people, our clients' houses, so they can do these virtual spin classes.
Yeah. Is that going to carry on? I think as much as we like thinking about the past and reminiscing about how it was when we were younger, if you look at the kids now, what they're into and the opportunities they've got to stay at home and be alone and be at the same time socializing online, I think it's only wrong. Going one way.
It's wrong though, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
You know, look, I'm going to ask you now, I'm going to put you on the spot. Tell me about your childhood. Where was it? Was it in Wigan itself?
Wigan, yeah. I grew up in Wigan. We never moved house. It was a small village called Shevington. Beautiful place. And yeah, we were just outside 24/7. My mum was, I was very lucky looking back. My mum was really proactive and what's the right word? Just dedicated to making sure that we were out all the time. We had activities planned.
To a better self.
Yeah, when I mean, we were younger, we did sports.
Yeah, you were quite lucky. So Wigan is quite a hotbed of sport, isn't it? So I should imagine it's almost in the DNA of the entire area.
Yeah,
Wigan Rugby League, Wigan football. You know, it's
good athletic system. Football
cricket
is really
as well.
Good. Yeah, cricket.
I mean, yeah, I was the same. You know, I'm a lot older than you. So I was about 10 in the mid 70s, and God, those are the days. You know, we used to march out of the house at about 8 o'clock in the morning with our little jam sandwiches and our little orange squash. And then we'd go off and play soldiers or whatever in the forest, in the local woods. And then about 5, 6 o'clock, or probably 5 o'clock, your mum would stand on the doorstep and like, you could hear it all around the sort of the estate. Richard, your tea's ready. And then we'd just drop. And of course, one time, I can remember, we're in these woods and we found some septic water. So we thought we'd build a bridge. And which idiot was the one volunteered to go and test out the bridge and what collapsed halfway through?
Oh, no.
And then I spent the next 2 months at home with yellow jaundice. So,
seriously.
But again, we had that freedom. We had that inquisitive nature to get out there. And again, our kids of today, and I've got 3 kids, and again, they're all quite old now. But again, I was having that struggle even 15, 20 years ago, trying to sort of get them out and about and active.
I'd find it difficult, I think, because you just always want, you know what was good for you, don't you? And you always want to pass that on to your children, but it's just not the way the world is anymore. It's sad. It is very sad. But I think, you know, to be successful in this world, you need to be adapt. You need to be clued up on these devices. And it's almost like an extension of yourself, isn't it? The mobile phone. What these kids could do with phones now is just incredible. The editing, videos they produce, the games that they play. I mean, there's millionaires now. There's millionaire e-sports stars that are making fortunes. You know, in the past, you'd be kicking your kids off playing on the PlayStation. Now they're making millions.
Where's it going, my friend? Where's it going?
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. What else you got to tell me? Anything good?
Well, I've been doing a little bit of research, looking at what's happening in the city. So I believe now, touching back on the coronavirus situation, 75% of the city has now been sterilized, apparently. Now, I'm not sure what sterilized means, but apparently they've been having these drones flying around. I haven't seen them in real life. I've only seen them on clips on Instagram and Facebook, what people have shared and the WhatsApp groups. Have you seen any of these drones flying around?
No, I haven't, but I've certainly seen sterilisation in my street here in Jumeirah, in Almanara.
Yeah. What do they do? Tell me what you see.
There's a lot. Again, I was in my lounge, obviously, but there's a lot of flashing blue and orange lights outside, very slow. Yeah. And but then the smell of chemical sterilisation products actually came through, not in a great upsetting way, but you could actually smell.
Really?
For the next few hours, the actual sterilisation that they used in the streets.
Yeah.
So I know it's been done here. And I tell you what I've noticed as well, the last two or three days, there's a lot more police very slowly patrolling, daytime and nighttime.
You're right.
Seeing the blue lights go past, just checking that, you know, I think they've been quite firm now on you must get the permit to go out. And if it's like clock your car with no permit.
It's incredible, isn't it? I think all of the police are just out on the roads constantly. Anytime I look out on the balcony, I see maybe two or three patrol cars driving around the marina, which I never saw before.
What's your view from your balcony?
View from the balcony is, so I'm in Marina Gate and we're facing the back side. We're not facing down the water. We're on the opposite side. So I've got a full Burj Al Arab view through about 15 buildings in the distance.
You stand on the beer
which
train
is well worth the extra 5k that I paid for the yearly rental. And I've got the golf course as well to the right, which is quite nice.
Just to like rip the salt into the wounds. What are you seeing down on the streets though? Are you seeing, because when this first happened, I know a few of you guys live down in the marina.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people out exercising, walking.
Honestly,
it's quite frustrating for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, my first thoughts were frustration and I was really annoyed. It seemed to be as if people were taking it as a holiday. I mean, I'd never seen the streets as busy during the week. That first week or so, people were just going outside. And it's like, we know it's bad for us. You know, we know that it's not safe. Well, I think a lot of people do now. But unless it's enforced, which it has been now, people will still do it. I mean, look at smoking, for example. We know it's bad. We know it causes cancer. And they even put, you know, those horrible stickers on the packets, which knock me sick. But people still do it. You know, because it's not illegal. It is illegal to smoke inside now as it is in the UK. And that's when people will stop. It has to be enforced, which is a shame, really. But I guess, you know, you've just got... I mean, look at America now. It's absolutely
I was just about
crazy.
To say that. Crazy, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like civil war, isn't it? You know, if you believe the papers.
Madness.
Florida opens the beaches and within half an hour, the beaches are packed. There's people out on the streets sort of saying, you know, unlock us now, we want freedom, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I bet you they won't be saying that if one of them or their close families goes down with the virus and ends up in hospital.
I know.
Fighting for their lives.
I feel really sorry.
Change a few attitudes.
I feel really sorry for the care workers and the hospital staff in the States because, you know.
Everywhere.
I'm worried.
Everywhere. They're absolute heroes, aren't they? In the States, in the UK, here in the UAE. Everywhere.
But imagine, you know, being in the States, being a co-worker, working in a hospital and seeing these idiots running around on the streets and, you know, we want our freedom. We're not going to listen to you. Yeah. We'll do what we want. If we catch it, we catch it. And you know what's coming, basically. If you look at the UK, I mean, America's had a lot of cases already, but it's a big country, isn't it? So I don't think... I think in some spots, they're feeling it a lot more than others. Like, I know New York's really bad, but it's only going
to
spread.
40,000 deaths now. I think they're close to 40,000
deaths,
which is frightening, isn't it, really? And they still go out there and do what they're doing. And then the most poignant photograph, I think, of yesterday was the actual healthcare workers. Was it Pennsylvania? They're actually in their scrubs and their masks actually standing there silently trying to block these protests. And it's just frightening, really.
Yeah.
As I say, the annoying thing is, the minute one of those guys or their families go down with COVID-19, you know, they'll change their tune very quickly.
My concerns with America, just quickly, is they are the driving force for the world, isn't it? The dollar is the world currency. And if these guys are you know, not taking it seriously and they're just prolonging this whole situation for everybody, the world's going to be in more of a mess than it potentially already could be, which is frustrating.
Again, without getting too political on it, I think Trump wants America to open very quickly, get sort of the business of America open. And I think that's probably sort of geared into his presidential re-election hopes later this year. But it's just, you know, we're messing with people's lives. Here, you know, there is no messing, right? We will not risk ourselves until we have beaten this. I think Emirates were delaying or rearranging their flights again yesterday, putting them further back until, you know, and again, they were doing these instant testings, weren't they? Before you get on an airplane, what, a 10-minute blood test, was it? You were telling me?
I was going to say, I don't know how they do it, but there's some sort of the trialing initiatives to test passengers now. So this is another thing that we mentioned in the last episode, the benefits that are going to come out of this situation and how we're going to get better, you know, all over the world. So they're testing passengers now, apparently, as you enter the plane. So, you know, when you go through the scanners and you get checked for, you know, weapons or whatever it is, drugs. Now they're going to trial in technology to actually test for certain viruses. So that could be interesting, but it could also be, you know, pretty upsetting if you didn't know that you had a virus and you went to go on holidays, which you've been looking forward to for the past 12 months, and they stop you.
And again, that grey area of, like, you know, your ability to travel for whatever reason is in the hands of an airport official, and are they going to be overzealous? I don't know.
Yeah.
Where is this all going? Where is this world going?
I know. It's scary, isn't it? Change is very scary. And it will be met with resistance when it first starts.
Come on, let's lighten it. Let's lighten this conversation. Come on.
Go on.
I know you and I were having a bit of a laugh last night talking about this. So let's open it up. So you and me, my friend, we're in the pub, we're in the bar, we're having a drink, and we get talking.
Nice.
Liam,
yep.
If you had a million dirhams to spend, where would you spend it in Dubai? What would you buy?
Good, yeah, very good question. We had some fun with this. I think for a million, personally, not sounding snobbish, but I think in Dubai, a million dirham limit would be an investment. You know, it wouldn't be somewhere that I dream of living. So up to a million dirhams, I'd really like the signature living project in JVC. Obviously, it's not ready yet, so I can't say for certain exactly how it's going to be, but everything so far looks fantastic. I've been on the site and I've looked at the show apartments. They've actually finished a few apartments on the actual site. And I think it's great. Really good value for investors.
What'd you get there?
They're guaranteeing 7.1% net return for 3 years, which is fantastic. And that's still going, no matter what's happening with the situation out there. For a million, you could easily get a one bedroom. I think they're 750. You'd be close to getting one of the two bedrooms, which are on the top level with a private pool. So they'd be fantastic, yeah. So I think I always offer that.
Who's the developer?
Looking for investments.
Who's the developer?
The developer is Green Group. So they've not done loads before, but they've done a few projects in JVC. They've built, they've done a villa in Jumeirah Golf Estates, and they've done a villa on the Palm. And I've seen the quality. It's fantastic.
Good to know.
Yeah. How about you? Well, what would you go for? A million dirhams.
Yeah. Again, I was looking. A million is relatively difficult. There's a lot of choice out there, but it's where would you sort of park your million?
Yeah.
And, you know, get, if you like, your return, whether it's yourself or as an investment. I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about Old Town. I like Old Town. Emaar built...
Great location.
The low rise. There's about 4 or 5 floors per unit. We're talking about Zafran, we're talking about Yantoun, Rihan, Miska, places like that. And again, they've just got a nice old world feel to them. They've got like nice Arabic dark wood paneling and architecture.
Yeah.
You're not, as I said, when I first came, they put me in JLT. I was waiting 10 minutes every morning, every night, just for a lift to take it to the 34th floor, back down from the 34th floor. I was taking 10 minutes to get the car out. So, again, 4 or 5 floors, Emaar, spacious, nice feel to it, nice pools, not overcrowded.
Yeah.
And again, the beautiful thing about Old Town is you walk out onto the boulevard,
you've got cafes.
You've got the Opera House, you've got Dubai Mall just across the road. And again, you've got the Palace Hotel. You know, that's what I'm, that's what I really like indeed.
Perfect. Well, look, we've now got Mr. Jason Hayes waiting to come into the call, so we can continue this little experiment
as to
what we go on the next one. Yeah, so that's good. Yeah. Right, let's add Jason into the call, the $1 billion broker. Let's see.
Jason, for anybody who doesn't know, is our CEO and founder of luxuryproperty.com.
Yeah.
He is the most gregarious, outgoing, eccentric, but lovely businessman I've come across in a long, long time. He's got more stories than Jack and Rory, basically. He'll keep us entertained. I promise you that.
And here he is now. Currently on mute, Jason. I think.
Yeah, you see. Who's got more stories than Jack and Laurie? I haven't got more stories than Jack and Laurie. Hello, Mr. Hayes. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks, guys. Are we recording? Is this going to be live on the internet?
It is, yeah. You're live now.
Oh, my God. One second. Let me just watch. There you go. Brush my hair. Ready for
That's
this.
Looking great. I like the plug for Bath Rugby as well.
There you go.
Yeah, you've got just, that in there. You planned that well.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for your very kind invitation to participate on the show. I'm very excited.
No problem. We know you're an avid listener. And we know
yes, I am.
For a long time.
And it's been good. And I did spot some swearing on it as well. I don't know if you got my message.
Oh, did you?
Liam, stop swearing.
It must have been Richard.
Five dirhams going into the swear jar at the office.
Well, I'll tell you what's worse than swearing, getting the names wrong of our guests, which Richard did in the last episode.
Do you know what happened there? And I'll say, just as I was about to say Megan, one of my tenants messaged me who was called Tanya. So I had the word Tanya in my brain. So I said, all right, Tanya, so what? And you went, oh, no. And I went, oh, no.
There was
no.
A silent pause.
So my phone is turned upside down, well away from this screen. Anyway, yeah. Let's get into Mr. Jason Hayes in the nicest possible way. We've got some exciting questions.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, Jason, how are you finding the lockdown so far? Obviously, a big change from what we're used to. And I imagine your daily routine has changed drastically because you're obviously out and about quite a lot. How are you finding it?
Look, my mother-in-law's here. She's at So, I think to begin with, it was rather strange. By nature, as you guys know, I enjoy getting out and about and meeting people, and I'm very busy and pride myself on being very hands-on. Mrs. H and I have had lunch together throughout the course of the week for the first time in years. The last time actually it was like this was when I sold my companies back in the UK in 2007. So with us spending lots of time together, I love it, brilliant. It's fascinating spending time with Jack and Molly in terms of, it feels like reconnecting with them. That might sound a bit strange as if I'm a bad dad or something, but I promise you I'm not. But it's a case of you're sort of reconnecting with the guys a little bit because you're spending so much time together. I'm very cognizant of what's going on around the world. So I'm very grateful to be here, to be safe, to have our loved ones with us and to be safe. So for me, this is a no-brainer. I'm reading, I'm enjoying some downtime, I'm sleeping, I'm possibly enjoying one too many malt whiskies of an evening. I think at the moment it's time for us all to reflect and all to I suppose think about our experiences and also think about what the future is going to hold for us as well. So for me, obviously impact on the business is enormous, as we all know, and impact on real estate is enormous. But what's more enormous, the impact on people's families who are losing loved ones and they can't be there when those loved ones are passing through this invisible, horrible, horrible disease that is not in any way, shape or form, it affects everybody, doesn't it? I think I'm coping quite well. I've obviously, have stopped shaving and stopped wearing a tie to work.
So here's a bit of a serious question following on to that. I know you've got good contacts in the government and also with Andrew, your fellow partner and owner of the business. We're looking to the crystal ball. When do you think Dubai's going to come out of this?
Do you say when or?
Yeah, when? When?
I honestly don't know, and I think it would be wrong of us to even sort of guess. I'm really happy to be led by this government. I think they're doing an excellent job. I think when we come out of this, Dubai will be seen as a safe haven that it is in terms of good governance, good leadership, solid leadership. We had the Dubai Economic Department had a date of the 18th, I think it was. For when things might go back to normal, then they extended that by another week. I think there's going to be a structured return to life protocol, if you want to call it that. Yeah. We had 484 cases identified yesterday here in the Emirates, and that's obviously probably quite a large figure. I think it's been running at that figure now for a while, because their testing protocols are absolutely excellent. So I think we've got another, maybe another week, couple of weeks, and then we will see some sort of some process in terms of returning to normal life. Tough one. What do you think? What's your views?
It's difficult because Ramadan's coming up, isn't it? In a week, I believe, 28th of April, it's been announced. So that's going to be interesting to see. I mean, Ramadan's usually a time, we've discussed it before on the show, it's a very social time, isn't it? With the gathering of families, and they have these big communal iftars, and you almost open up your doors to your neighbours, which obviously can't happen. So my personal opinion is that they're going to keep this lockdown on throughout Ramadan, which is another month. And then, like you said, slowly start to allow different sectors of the city to come out and get back to normality, hopefully.
I agree, but I think, and you and I, Liam, we're affected by this in a massive way, but when you think about Jason being a business owner and therefore responsible, not only for his brokers, but his backroom team, I bet, as I say, you've had some sleepless nights, Jason.
Yeah, well, it's had a catastrophic impact on businesses across the world. We saw that last night with oil hitting minus 40 on the West Texas. For us as a small startup, a small boutique digital destination, it was immense. I mean, absolutely immense. We furloughed eight members of the team from our operations team, and of course our brokerage structure is a commission only structure, so the impact it has on you guys. From my perspective, it's a time to kick on. So whilst the entire world is being conservative and contracting and not spending money on marketing and you know, pushing the envelopes, Andrew and I we're the opposite. Our view is you know, we enjoy great market share and we're pushing to try and get more market share. We've got a small boutique brokerage, but you know, we're bringing on new members of that team, so trying to expand and make the most of this this period of being stuck at your desk, so to speak. You know, I think we've got some really, really exciting new tech coming out. I think you guys know a little bit about that. We've got some very exciting things happening on the tech side of the business, and it's for those guys that we had to let go or furlong or whatever phrase you want to use, my personal obligation to them is you will be coming back. You will be coming back, and you will be, you know, you will be recompensed for any lost pay, et cetera, et cetera. In order to do that, we've got to work harder, we've got to work smarter, and we've got to get revenues up. That's a very sort of personal thing from us, but I saw this morning that Virgin Atlantic Australia have filed for administration, and it looks as if, you know, a number of companies are in significantly hot water. Now, I've always structured my businesses so that we've some people might call it a sinking fund, but I've always called it like a rainy day sort of scenario. You know, what would happen if, and to make sure that we're able to cope with that. But no amount of pre-management and no amount of expertise can prepare us for this. You know, it's been something that's just sort of, you know, shook us all. And I think so, Rich. And I think rather fearfully as well. I think we're at the start of seeing the effects of this. You know, if you were to ever say to me, okay, you know, oil's going to hit zero, I'd be like, don't be so stupid. Of course it's not. And then you look at the futures for May and they're at minus 40. And
Jason's froze.
Technical issue.
Never mind.
We're back. We had a little delay then. Can you hear us now?
Well, that was the best bit. You missed the best bit.
We can never get that back.
No, not sorry. the impact's been immense. It's been absolutely immense.
Okay. So go on, Jason.
And it continues to be felt as well. I think we're seeing the start of it. I think we will see liquidity issues across our country here in the United Arab Emirates, and then across the region, and in turn across the world. And that will have a material effect on our business, and also on other people's as well.
We're going to come back to that later. We've got some interesting questions about how you see Dubai real estate. But I think to give people a flavour of Mr. Jason Haynes, I think we need to talk about your past a little bit.
So
there's every chance my wife might be listening to this. Maybe we better not.
Yeah. Talk to us about, I know we've discussed this on the golf course a few times, but talk to us about how you first sort of got a taste for real estate and a passion for real estate. How did it all start?
I went up to, when I was doing my A-levels, I was predicted to do rather well and to follow in my father's footsteps and go into the UN or the Foreign Office or whatever, and I didn't because I'm stupid, and I ended up getting a place at university, a place called Middlesbrough up in the northeast of England, and I went to what was Teesside Polytechnic actually when I went, and then after a year it transferred to becoming the University of Teesside, and I read philosophy and politics, which is, and why, and people often ask me why. Well, the honest answer is it was 4 hours a week, which basically means I could concentrate on enjoying playing rugby and genuinely being mischievous. But I had no money. So we haven't, you know, my father's hugely successful. My family are incredibly wealthy, and they've been very clever about making sure that nobody gets any of the money. So it's it was a case of each of us had to go out into the world on our own 2 feet, so to speak. So I went up to university with no money whatsoever, really. I fell into real estate. I fell into student accommodation more than anything else by realizing that if I managed to buy a little 4-bed terrace house and knock about a couple of the rooms, I could turn it into a 5 or 6-bed, rent them out to mates of mine. And that would not only cover the mortgage, but it would also cover my, you know, my university living expenses. We didn't pay fees back in the day, but it would cover my university living expenses and my, you know, my desire to travel to far-flung paid places and things. That's pretty much how it started. I blatantly lied to some poor bank somewhere and said that I had all this big trust fund and stuff. I didn't. And back in the day, back in 1991, nobody, I'm not going to say nobody cared, but you know, if you were seen to be a good chap, then you could get funding, and it was I think it was £11,500 my first property on Clarendon Road, and it was a MIRIS mortgage, which is mortgage interest relief at source, which is a special sort of mortgage for first time buyers. So in my second year, I bought 2 more properties, both on MIRIS mortgages. Bear in mind, you're only allowed one. So it was just a case of, I'm not going to use the word fraud because that probably was what it was. But at the time, I didn't know that you couldn't have more than one. So, and then I was just renting them out. And then basically, renting them out allowed me to produce enough money to put deposit down on things. I used, you could get a student loan back then. I think, well, you probably can now, I suppose, but you can get a student loan. So I used a student loan and started that way and used all of my student loan and put it in as deposits and sort of, you know, begged and borrowed and stealed. And, you know, it was pretty hard work. When I left uni, it was something that I wanted to do in a sort of full-time capacity, and basically that's what I did. I set up a company that started doing a lot of buy-to-let mortgages, which was interest-only mortgages, but buying cheap properties, so I couldn't afford to go to expensive places. So bought a lot of property in Hull in the east, riding of Yorkshire, and then in Lincoln, then in Loughborough, Exeter and Durham. And that culminated, it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. I'm making this sound really easy. I can tell you the time. Incredibly hard work. You know, my first company car. Yeah, it was a completely student portfolio, but I did everything. So my first company car was a Ford Transit van, E46 UKH. I can remember the thing. We had there was no branding or anything else for it, you know. Culminated in sort of by about 2001, we got to about just shy of 5,000 student bed spaces across five cities. And yeah, it got pretty sort of like, you're like, okay, you know, we were getting there. And then, you know, going through in 2000, and well, it's funny how life is weird, isn't it? In 2006, had a huge argument. I mean, if you think the fallouts in the office at the moment are heated, you should have been there for this one. I had a huge argument with our marketing and communications director, who had foolishly put something together that the Sunday Times had picked up on, which basically said, look out for this young property entrepreneur from the north of England, etc., and which culminated in them featuring me, or putting me into, I don't know quite how you do it, into the Sunday Times rich list. And I think I was the youngest person in the UK at that time to have made the rich list back in 2006, wherever it was. And I was furious, absolutely furious, because all of the, a little bit like our business now, everything had been done on a value basis, and everything had been done on driving costs and driving value. And then all of a sudden, one of our, well, she didn't stay in the job long, to be fair, after that, but one of our stupid communications people put something out. But that ultimately led to me selling the business. So, you know, strange things happen, don't they? And and I was approached by a South African chap in 07, early 07, and who was keen to get into real estate. As we know, the hardest part of real estate is building a portfolio, an income producing portfolio. But building those portfolios is really, really tough. And then this chap came forward with a sort of a weird, I mean, it was quite bizarre how it happened at the time, because I definitively wasn't for sale. It's a little bit like now somebody coming to me and saying, would you sell luxuryproperty.com? I would be like, well, you know, we're not on the market. No, I'm not interested. Off you go. And then he started talking figures, and I was like, oh, well, actually, funny enough, I'd often considered an exit. And that led to conversations, which then led to KPMG, who act for me in all of my business interests, basically placing it. I don't quite know how they did it, and I'm not going to pretend to, but they placed it. And ultimately, we sold it to a London hedge fund in 07. At the time, I knew I was highly geared. You know, we were well-structured, incredibly well-structured, ISO 9001 in terms of operating standards, really, really good management team. I was primarily involved in the acquisitions side, because as you guys know, I'm not very good on customer service and dealing with staff. So I had a great management team, and then we sold it as the market was overheating. So I kept thinking to myself, I might need to get on and get this sold, because, you know, I could feel, you know, stuff that I bought in Loughborough, where you're like, you know, I might have paid maybe £100,000 for a property in Loughborough, and now I'm being told it's worth 250,000. You're like, it's not. It's still it's a lovely property, but it's still a property in love. So I took the exit and sort of went to live on the beach.
Yeah, exactly.
When you say lived on the beach, is this where Los Angeles comes into it, or is that a later part of the story?
well, basically, what I did is we're not going to have enough time on this, I'm sure, but basically I'd done a tax structure with the Isle of Man government, where I was domiciled in the Isle of Man, and they had a tax treaty with...
Oh, lost it.
I think he's guarding his secrets. He's not saying where the tax treaty was.
are you back?
Sorry, which bit did he get? Did he miss something?
Got up to the Isle of Man, which was in partnership with.
So basically, they had a tax agreement with the island of Barbados. So this is a bit weird, but you actually, when you go offshore to the Isle of Man, you do a deal directly with the Isle of Man government on what tax you're going to pay them. You negotiate.
Wow.
But yeah, it's cool. It was really cool. So basically, we then had the option. So our children were both very, very young. Jack would have been about four or five. Molly would have been two. And we had the choice of home being the Isle of Man or Barbados. It was really difficult.
Very difficult.
Yeah, it was one of those where we're like, not too sure. Love the experience. We were on the island for a couple of years. Loved it, absolutely loved it. The whole idea was I would have been sort of 30. Probably 35 at the time. And the whole idea was I was going to take a couple of years of retirement. All I'd known since being very, very young is work, and for me, work is all consuming, 24 hours a day, 7 days, it's all consuming. And so the whole idea was I was going to go chill out and relax and, maybe not carry quite so many pounds and that sort of thing. The opposite happened. I sort of discovered the love of Barbadian rum and it was great. For 6 months I was laying on a beach scuba diving. I'm a dive master, so I love diving and scuba diving and then scuba diving in the morning and golf in the afternoon, and to change things up I'd golf in the morning and dive in the afternoon. It was that sort of lifestyle. But after about a month, I was bored out of my tree. I was absolutely, I was incredibly, incredibly bored. At that point in time, I probably should have sort of sat and talked to somebody and said, one of these, I think they call them life coaches and things now, don't they?
Yep.
About what do you want from life? What I didn't know then and what I know now is I love building and scaling companies. Love the challenges. But I love the challenges that it delivers, and I get this immense sense of achievement and satisfaction from seeing something come from nothing to growing it to whatever it becomes. So I bought a company called propertyandhomes.com in Los Angeles, which was a company that specialized in buying distressed real estate, flipping it technically, which is the American phrase. We would say that refurbishing properties and then bringing them back to market. So I'd been sort of looking at what property things would I be doing, and I quite liked the tech side of what they were doing. So basically that culminated in me buying that company, and then I would be flying backwards and forwards, and the net result was that Jack and Molly were getting to a stage where we had to think about where we were going to school them and things, which culminated in us moving to the bright lights of Los Angeles. It was great. I love my time on Barbados. We sold the house there, a place called Ginger Lily, which is up on Turtleneck Ridge. It was absolutely gorgeous, and it was one of those where you're like, I wonder whether I should have just kept that as a holiday home. But at the time, we thought it was the right thing. And again, it was one of those where, and sometimes in life, you're just better to be lucky than good. A little bit like my golf, Liam, to be fair. Better to be lucky than good. I think I paid $5 million for that property, sold it $7.5 million. And it was one of those where you're just like, better to be lucky than good. That home's now probably worth, I don't know, Barbados has gone through a horrific property drop, so it's probably worth three. It's one of those where timing as well is everything.
Exactly.
So how long were you in LA for?
Five years. loved it and loathed it in equal measure. It's a fascinating place, very difficult to do business. Obviously, it's a different jurisdiction to anything at all that I'm used to. The Dubai jurisdiction here works alongside, in many respects, the British Land Registry jurisdiction, the British way of doing things. Of course, it's the Arabic way, but it's and Barbados was the same. But in Los Angeles, completely and understandably, completely different. Difficult market to crack into, and difficult, culturally difficult. Loved my time there, loved the people there, hugely successful. Sold the business in 2010. Really successful exit for us. But it was sort of an interesting sort of 2011, but interesting experience in terms of you imagine it to be all quite, you know, quite spectacular and quite, yeah, sort of glitzy and glamour.
As we sit here, and I know you've had LA dealings, I'm thinking Bel Air, I'm thinking Beverly Hills, I'm thinking, yeah, I'm thinking of, like, you know, beautiful full length glass mansions everywhere and that ultra millionaire lifestyle. Was it like that?
Well, we lived in a place called Brentwood, which is, for the discerning few, shall I say, it's quite lovely. And it really was quite spectacular home. We loved it. The properties that we were working on were in those sort of areas. And then I moved out to a place called Westlake Village, where we did a lot of investments and that sort of thing. My overriding memory is just traffic. traffic.
I've heard that before, LA.
You know, my overriding memory, yeah, is, you know, you're going to meet with the lawyers to sign some contracts, and you would leave 2 hours in advance to get, you know, 2 miles away. So traffic was a big thing. Yeah, look, it was great. You know, our next door neighbour was Tom Selleck, and, you know, some chap from the Eagles, and, you know, it's all quite fantastic, and at the same time somewhat sort of plastic as well. We're just getting busy again in LA. I mean, Brendan is yeah, you know, we've started marketing stuff over there. We're getting busy again over there. What I was always quite fascinated by as well is the disparity. I am, I think, at heart a champagne socialist. You know, I want to see everybody doing well, not just the few. And you would leave, I would leave to drive to the office, and if you looked left, you would have, you know, this most incredible plethora of wealth and opulence. And then if you look right, you would have something that you would be more used to seeing in a third world country in terms of homelessness and deprivation, that sort of thing. And I would struggle with that a little bit. You know, it was the bit of Los Angeles and of California in general that I didn't really get. You know, those that had definitively had, and then those that hadn't just didn't have that chance to get to that next step. And at the same time, my children were beginning to develop American accents, which was something I couldn't. Heaven forbid.
So what happened after that? What happened when you decided to leave LA?
Well, obviously, selling the business was prompted partly by my family, my father-in-law taking rather unwell. He's still with us, thankfully. But part of that, and the other part of it was that technically I'd complied with the terms of my tax agreement with the British and Isle of Man government so that I could return to the UK without paying any money. You have to do a 5-year period. So we went back home to Somerset, Jack and Molly into Millfield School, and enjoying life in Somerset, I was doing a lot of private advisory and a lot of private.
You stuck again for a second.
Have a guess. We lost you then again for a little second. Private, you were doing some private advisory and some brokerage as well.
So through our company in London, we were doing a lot of, I was doing a lot of sort of investment advisory primarily either London or into Saudi. We had a lot of stuff into Dubai, and then a lot of stuff which was property development advisory. So in Cornwall, by example, we built 4 eco beach houses on the coast, and you know, buying old hotels and converting them, and that sort of thing, which sort of prompted my, you know, Dubai has always been somewhere that I've been quite fascinated in, and always been probably one of the world's most favorable taxation regime. So when you do real estate, the tax on any profit is so incredibly strong in the United States. In the United States, we use structures out of Delaware and things, but it still didn't really help with what our onerous tax levies. And it was the same in the UK. You know, we got to the point where I'm like, okay, so I'm looking at this deal, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to take all this risk, I'm going to make all of this effort, yeah. I'm going to tie up all of this capital for X amount of time, and I'm actually going to give 50% of that profit away. And please don't get me wrong, I've got no problems at all in paying and supporting the British government, etc. But it was just onerous, absolutely onerous. We couldn't get any structures that worked. We use some Jersey property unit trusts, so Jersey J-puts and things, and we use various other structures that worked. But as you saw with our friend Jimmy Carr, all of these things get sort of torn to bits and come back and haunt you. So I wanted a regime where a taxation structure that would work for me as a family man for us, and also where a place where, you know, we could build a life for ourselves and the children. We looked long and hard at Switzerland, loved Switzerland, but rather interesting there, the cantons do you a 2-year deal and then they renegotiate with you after 2 years, which again, I was like, by which point you're there and you're established. And then I came over and we started looking at companies to buy, found a great little company that I thought would be a great one.
Listen, when was the first time you actually visited Dubai? For a holiday or with a business idea?
2000. When did the Burj Al Arab open?
I think it was 2000, wasn't it? Or 2001, maybe?
It'd been open like a month or something, and we'd come over. We'd
so
come
right at the start of everything.
Yeah, Andrew and I'd come over, and we were here for a week. Loved it, absolutely loved it. My first impression was, this place is nuts. This place is nuts. I'd never seen so many cranes, and the prices didn't make any sense. You know, you're looking at gorgeous homes that were, you know, not comparable to anything that we would have seen in London or in the States, but there were mental prices. You're like, oh my God, how does that work? That's weird. You know, the quality looked great, the homes looked lovely, but you're like, one second, how can that be 5 times of what it would cost me in Florida? You know, it was bonkers. Back again in 2003, and then probably sort of, you know, twice a year from there, obviously, business wise, and then private, you know, private travel. So very, you know, for us, very Dubai's been very sort of close to the family in terms of, you know, a place that we would elect to come visit. And then, you know, in 2016, we started looking at investments over here, looking at what, you know, brokerages possibly would be for sale, or what investment companies would be for sale, or you know, that side of things, and then you know, the process started basically. And from there, when you start really looking at Dubai, what's rather interesting is if you look from the outside, even after all of that advisory to all of those clients, I never really understood that we had world-class healthcare. When I say we, I'm talking about Dubai, that Dubai had world-class healthcare. Because at the time, my advisory didn't touch on that. At the time, and you know, I remember a Saudi fund that I was doing something with on some logistic, some warehouses and stuff. And at the time, I'd never given any thought to, oh my gosh, they've got incredible schools in Dubai, incredible schools that are comparable with the best schools that you can get in England or the States. And I hadn't given that, you know, it doesn't come into your consciousness until you're actually serious, you know, you're here and you're looking at the city. So for a number of years, Dubai was just a little bit like Hong Kong and Singapore are to me now. Yeah, we do work there, and yeah, we're engaged in both of those cities, but we don't really understand them quite as deeply as we possibly should. When I started, you know, when we got to the point of, okay, we're going to invest over here, that was just based on, because why wouldn't you? That's what it was based on. You know, most tolerant society in the world, some of the finest educational institutions in the world can be found here.
Okay, and how did you get on setting the business up? Was it quite, you know, you've obviously set up business all around the world. How was setting up a business in Dubai?
Really, really tough. Super frustrating. We wanted to get the pillars of the business right. So, you know, Andrew is, as you know, he's very much dots I's, crosses T's, and he's all about structure. For me, I'm always looking at the exit. So at some point, I'm going, don't worry, chaps, not now. At some point, I'm going to put this onto the stock market. At some point, I'm going to allow a management buyout. Why would Richard, as one of our directors, and Liam, as one of our directors, not buy the company out from me? You know, at some point, I'm going to take an exit. So for me, at the time of setting the company up, I wanted to get the structure right. So I wanted to get the name right. I bought a company called Mayfair Real Estate. And I wanted to convert that name, which is a very simple process anywhere in the world. I wanted to convert that name to Luxury Property LLC. And no, it can't be done. Oh, well, you know. And then, of course, by nature, I don't, you know, name doesn't really work for me. So I was sort of pushing. And then, you know, of course, we are called Luxury Property LLC because it says what we do on the tin. And then I wanted to protect the copyright of the company and protect the trademarking and that sort of thing, and the process was, you know, please don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining about the process, but it's one of those where you're like, okay, I need to trademark this and get that done. And the entire setting up of the company, just, you know, it doesn't get, this is my third company, third corporate entity, obviously a number of substructures under that, but you know, the process doesn't get any easier no matter how many times you do it. But it's always done, you know, the sort of bureaucracy is always done with a smile, you know, it's always done with a smile. So, you know, I pride myself on my emotional intelligence, and these guys are just, you know, when you're setting up the company, you're setting up the bank accounts, and you're setting everything up, everyone's so lovely, and they're so, like, they genuinely want you to do well. You know, in this city, unlike, they talk about the American dream, maybe we should have the Dubai dream, because people over here in the corridors of power and in the corporate institutions genuinely want you to succeed. They want you to succeed so that the city succeeds. But yeah, it was, you know, it's a headache, you know, when you go through that, headache and you come out the other side. And it was rather interesting. I was crying into a glass of scotch the other evening, where basically saying that, you know, in 3 weeks, this pandemic has wiped out 3 years' work. Now, obviously it hasn't, of course it hasn't, but there will be many people who feel that way.
But again, we're lucky, and I know I've counted on your expertise, shall we say, with a couple of sales I've done to business owners coming out of Europe into Dubai. You know, you've got some good advice to give to any new business setups, haven't you? No, that's worked well for us.
Yeah. Again, I think it may be when a call comes through, it might block the Zoom. But yeah, fascinating stuff.
Is he with us or is he gone?
I think he may have dropped, but I'm sure he'll be able to reconnect. Yeah, it is. It's great, isn't it? I've really enjoyed working with Jason on a lot of the deals that we've done together, and with his help, the experience that he's got is invaluable, and it really does help to be able to speak on an investor at the same level. Whereas I'm advising them what I would do, Jason's advising them as what I did when I set up a company here, or when I bought my first place here, and that leveling out of of advice is fantastic. You're back with us, Jason.
I'm back.
So look, I think what would be really great now is if we put you on the spot a little bit. So obviously, with all of your experience, what advice would you give to a seller in this market? Now, obviously, that's a very vague and open-ended question, but any general advice, apart from listing your property with luxuryproperty.com, as we all know, you should.
Well, I mean, you know, that listing your home with luxuryproperty.com is a given, to be fair. I think if you're a seller in this market, quite simply, give some serious thought to the reason that you're selling. So yeah. if you're selling the home because you have a change of family circumstances, or a change in financial circumstances, or whatever it might be, and it's a liquidity issue, and you need to sell it, then my advice would be to price it realistically, to get good advisory from a knowledge broker, from somebody who knows exactly what they're doing, and then promptly bring it to market at the right price, and indeed it will transact. Yeah. If you're a seller who is just testing the market and just thinking about, and they're not committed to the process of sale, then my advice would be don't list it. Yeah. Because there is at this time a predatory approach to acquisitions. There are going to be people who are bidding low on homes, and they're trying to build in perceived price drops in the market into their offer price. So if they think the market is going to drop by 10%, as an example, then they are bidding now and then building in that 10%, that perceived drop right now. So if you're a seller, my view would be, give some clarity to the process. Think about how you're selling. Think about your marketing realization period and be very cognizant of that. The marketing realization period of a home in Dubai at this point in time, if it's a home valued over 5 million dirhams, the marketing realization period can be up to 9 months. And what I mean by marketing realization period is, you know, the time by which it actually takes to sell your home. So you've got to be very, very aware of that. But first and foremost, get great advice, and make sure that advice is delivered in the right way. Yeah. You and I know, well, we all know, don't we, that there's a number of brokers who pretend to know about the market and then...
Yeah.
They've got limited experience and zero knowledge. That's something.
We've had a bad sound bite there for about the last 20 seconds with Jason. Can you hear us?
I can hear you yet. Shoot.
Okay, yeah. Good. So that's very good advice. So I'm going to flip it on its head. What advice would you give to a buyer in Dubai today?
In many respects, probably the exact same advice, to be quite honest with you. I think first and foremost, it's about getting good advisory. Secondly, it's about understanding your own proceedability. So by example, you know, okay, are you looking to do this transaction in the next week, in the next month, in the next 6 months? What's the structure of your transaction? If it's going to be a finance deal, getting your pre-approval in hand prior to even start to look for real estate. And then indeed, when you get to the point where you're bidding on real estate, to actually be led by your broker who's advising you. So if a home is on the market for, shall we say, 10 million, and the open market value of that home, without a shadow of a doubt, will be, you know, in the region of 10 million, there's little to be achieved by bidding five. You know, there's little to be achieved because that bid isn't based on fact or indeed on presumption, of facts. So by being a genuine buyer, it's understanding that, you know, if the market moves, even in bad time, markets move by 3%, 4%.
Yeah. I think we've lost Jason again, but very, very true that, again, if it's over 10 million and it's a fair price and there's other comparables around at 10 million, why would anybody offer 5 million on something that they like, would conceive themselves living in as their home or as their investment? Because all they've got to do from that moment on is work with a very angry, upset, frustrated seller, and it's really going to cook the meal in such a way. A good, even the best property professional like Jason or like yourself, Liam, or dare I say like myself, we will struggle to build that what's the word, loyalty, if you like, back into the deal
relationship.
I think you're right, and I think it's how. In some respects, in Dubai, and one of the reasons why I love working over here is we're dealing with 200 different nationalities, and with that, 200 different cultures around the buy process. So for some, culturally, it will be all about the bartering, and no matter how much I say, look, why don't we just do something different and go forward with our best and final offer right at the start, culturally that just doesn't work. And I think if you're a buyer, you've just got to be cognizant of that, you know, culturally, if your modus operandi is just to offer best and final at the start, again, you might be better advised to work with your broker who will measure expectations. If you're a buyer, my overriding advice, if you're a buyer, is buy. That's my overriding advice at this point in time, because the market is, I don't believe the market's going to move much further. For sure, we have a supply demand matrix issue in Dubai at the moment, and we've got a lack of confidence in the city. We believe that we're going to have an Expo 2020 delay. I personally think that might play into our favour in light of recent events. But the fundamentals of Dubai remain strong. Let me actually elaborate. My view is the fundamentals of Dubai have got stronger as a consequence of the management of this pandemic. So I believe we're actually going to have a little bit of pent up demand and a push coming through, and
we've lost you again there a little bit, but I think we've got your point. I think Dubai will come out of this better perhaps than it was before because of the way that they dealt with the situation.
I've got one really good question I want to put to you.
Let's wait till we've got the signal. Perfect, because I'm excited to hear this question.
Okay.
Are you ready?
No, I'm worried.
Right, Mr. Hayes, we are now going to appoint you as the CEO of Dubai Real Estate LLC. What steps will you take to improve the market in Dubai?
Oh, wow. Great question. And thanks for the heads up on it, you bugger.
The sound quality is not good, is it?
Well,
are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
I'm here.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
That's slightly better, yeah.
So, if indeed I were on that CEO of Dubai Real Estate LLC, my view would be that that my immediate response would be I need to float the economy. Now, what I mean by that is I need to get things moving. Again, I need to get things interesting. Now, I'm going to make this suggestion, being unaware of the financial impacts it might have on the wider Dubai economy. But the first thing I would do, to be fair, is I would either drop the land tax charge of 4% to 2%, or indeed just remove it completely. So the transfer fee that we pay, the 4%. Dubai Land Department fee, I would remove. What that does is saves people a phenomenal sum of money. And for many people, if they're financing, you know, they struggle to get the deposit together, and then on top of that, they've got to find a further 6%, so brokerage fees and then Dubai Land Department fees. Now, so for me, would
we've lost him again, haven't we?
Yeah. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, that's better.
Let's get back a bit, Jason, because it's really interesting. And we heard that you obviously you're going to lose the 4% fee, and you're just saying, and that will lead to, and then we lost you.
So what that will lead to is a little bit of a kickstart of the property market here in Dubai. It will make provision for. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Yeah, it just keeps freezing. I'm not sure. Tell Jack to get off the PlayStation. Maybe he's.
Yeah, exactly. when Andrix calls people for supper, we just turn the Wi-Fi off. That seems to work. So look, if indeed the government were minded to remove the 4% fee, what that would do is it would serve as to give everyone a little bit of a boost, a little bit of, oh, I'm going to do something. It's a call to action in many respects. The impact on the government indeed would be immense, I'm quite sure. But even if we just had it a window of opportunity, a month, 2 months, whatever it might be, just to do that, that would improve for people. They've already done a lot. You know, I've seen five point increases on loan to value rates for mortgages. Yeah. I would love to see an interest only product for Dubai. I think, you know, at the moment we're all on a straight line capital amortized basis, and a interest only product for Dubai would be really interesting, particularly as it's, you know, for the investors coming through to the market. We've had a period of a moratorium on new development launches. And I don't quite know if that's a formalised moratorium coming from the steering committee or whether that's just something agreed informally. But that seems to be helping in terms of, you know, we're not flooded with new off-plan inventory all the time. The process of off-plan at the moment is the root cause of the lack of confidence in the Dubai market, because we don't quite know where it's going to end. So if you own a property, or if you're about to buy a property in the marina, you have every right to be cognizant of the new Emaar development at Dubai Creek Harbour, because they're both comparable. And if indeed There are, you know, a flood of new towers coming through, but we have limits on inward migration and limits on demand. Then, of course, by nature, you might see people going towards those new towers. So I think what they've done in terms of the moratorium, if it were me, I would formalise that, and I would ask them to finish the projects that they've worked on, but allow the city time to grow into. And build. I personally would go for. Can you hear me? Okay, guys.
Yeah.
If I were the CEO of Dubai Real Estate LLC, I would also probably have more of a regulatory framework around the developers and the behaviours of the developers. And also around the real estate brokers themselves as well, because I think some of the actions of these brokers and developers are just serving us to undermine the market. And you know, I find things like, if you know, I don't want a car when I buy an apartment. I don't want it. What I want actually is an apartment that's properly priced, delivered on time, and delivered to a standard that one would expect. I don't want them to throw in a car. If I want a car, I'll go and buy a car. And I just think at the moment there's a little bit of nonsense around the developers with all of these crazy offers trying to get rid of their stock. When my view would be, do you know what? If you delivered on time, if your product was a good standard, if you had a proper handover protocol and snagging, and if indeed your service standards were as glossy as your brochures, you wouldn't have a problem. Yeah. You wouldn't have a problem. But you have a problem because your management standards aren't anywhere near where they need to be at point of delivery and around point of delivery. At point of sale, they're slick, aren't they? Slick.
Yeah.
But how many clients do we work with where, you know, they're getting the keys to a property and you're like, oh my gosh, it looks like Jack's built that. It's like, it's, you know, he's 17. It's like, you know, where you're just like, my gosh, you know, and I think back to the student accommodation buildings that we constructed, and I'm like, you know, you guys wouldn't, you know, this wouldn't get done. So that would be another thing I would do for that. I think as well, better communication. So at the moment, we rely on third party companies giving us property data from the Dubai Land Department. And that property data, statistics, damn statistics, I think is the phrase, that property data, I feel, is erroneous, it's massaged, it's not put together effectively. And I would love to see the Dubai Land Department actually produce something that's purely quantitative, something that is absolutely accurate, and it's coming from the horse's mouth, shall we say, as opposed to being prepared by third party consultancies. Is what I do, and then lastly, I would probably look to better regulate the valuers, and to make sure that the valuers are properly qualified, RICS qualified or equivalent, and that the valuation methodologies are done in accordance with the Red Book of the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors. I'm getting, you know, I'm very conscious that some of the values that, you know, that are being placed on properties don't make sense. They're either too high, because, you know, they're being sort of manipulated upwards, or indeed too low because the valuer is too risk averse. When you actually speak with the valuer, I did one recently on a property, lovely chap, very, very pleasant gentleman. And again, you know, delivered with a smile. He was a really, really nice guy, but unqualified. He wasn't a chartered surveyor. He was coming to look at the property. He was comparing apples with bananas. You know, it was a townhouse, and he was trying to compare it against a three-bedroom apartment in the same building. And, you know, such poor standards in terms of professional property advisory need to be looked at. With that being said, and I'm going to, and I mean this genuinely, we do operate in a very structured way over here, as we know. But that's what I would do if I was CEO.
That's a great answer.
Good points there, wasn't there?
Some very good points. Yeah, really good points. I love the part about the data. It's really frustrating, isn't it? When you just want to see what's sold clearly, because a lot of times they mix in data from remortgages, and even sometimes I think they're mixing the data from title deed applications. And there's just sometimes there's just no way to see what is going on in the real market. It should be public knowledge.
Sorry, Jason. Yeah.
132 transactions, villa transactions on the farm, Jumeirah, and then in the last year, approximately. And then, you know, our management team were going through it, and actually, I think that figure came out to 80. So, yeah. So the 52 were remortgages or were whatever they were. But you know, if you took an error rate of 5%, which one shouldn't do, but if you did, you know, that's an error rate that's enormous. And I think it's just about it being delivered in a way that that's, you know, that's transparent. And also of the moment, we wait too long for data as well, don't we? We all know that, don't we? You know, something sells and it transfers, but we don't see that on these systems that we've got, sometimes for another month or longer, bizarrely, and I don't quite know why that is, when really we want real-time data. You know, the moment it transfers, it should be available to us to see, because that's the most comparable of evidence, you know, the recent transfers.
Right, Mr. CEO, one last question related to that. How and where would you sell Dubai real estate around the world? How would you attract the right buyers, and what would you do? How would you promote Dubai Real Estate LLC to the world?
Oh, wow. Okay. I'd probably do exactly what they're doing at the moment, to be quite honest with you. I think there's parts of the world that we being Dubai, people don't know we exist. So we know, by example, that the Indian subcontinent and Africa, Europe, and parts of North America achieve by the way, I'm just being called for lunch, so you guys this is getting serious. Becoming between you and food, but there's genuinely parts of the world where we're not strong. North America, rather fascinatingly, you know, obviously we're led by digital traffic coming into luxurypropertycom. North America, Canada, Central America, South America, we don't get an awful lot of traffic coming into there. So, you know, wearing my CEO for Dubai Real Estate LLC, I'd probably be saying, you know, let's look at those markets, you know, Australasia, and then Asia in general. We know the markets where we're very strong, we're recognised as being strong. Let's go look at those other markets. Also, let's get the message right. I think too much glitz with our marketing for Dubai, and not enough substance, because the substance is the bit that is the key point. Yes, you can go and drive spectacular cars into the back of Ubers. at some point, I'm hoping to replace my beloved Maserati. But,
it's frozen again.
Yeah.
Frozen.
You're back now. Yeah.
Sorry. Too much glitz. We can drive spectacular cars. We can eat in the most incredible restaurants. We can shop in the most, you know, amazing shopping malls. We can go and watch the horse racing of an afternoon, and we can go to the opera later that evening. You know, the glitz of Dubai is quite clear for all to see, and it's all within this very, very small sort of radius of the city. The substance is what I would probably market more, Richard. I think I'd be basically going to the world and saying there's more to us than glitz and glamour, and I'd probably be pushing you know, the KHDA, the healthcare, the infrastructure, the crime rate or lack of, the tolerance that we all enjoy, and a lot of things that we take for granted. So I probably that probably be the angle that I would take, and that's the sort of geographical areas that I would push.
Fantastic. Another amazing answer. Well, we'll let you get off for your lunch. What are you having?
Fantastic. Yeah, I presume it's salad.
Have you been on a strict diet during the lockdown?
Well, quite. You know, I, as I keep telling Mrs. Hayes, I was built for comfort, not speed. So I'm sort of there. I mean, it's really frustrating because April's the month that I tend to spend most of the time running on the streets and going to the gym, but you know,
yeah, it's what it is.
It is what it is. You've got to see those. You've got to do those things.
Fantastic. Excellent. Well, thank you, Jason.
Answers excellent. Thank you, Rich, indeed.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed that conversation. And thanks to all our listeners. I just want to make the point again, if you did like this episode, then get in touch with us. You can now reach us on Instagram. We've got the Dubai Life Podcast Instagram handle, so you can reach us on there and let us know your comments. And the episode should be up later this afternoon. Thank you all for listening.